Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And so you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know, even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never change anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
And now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. They're going to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show you your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
Well, I was born in Brownsville in the 50s, and I lived on 45th and Forestville, which is a little short block, which is a great residential neighborhood. Then I, after the restrictive covenant was lifted, we moved to Chatham, and I grew up in Chatham, and then went away to college, came back, lived in Hyde Park, raised my kids in Hyde Park, and when they were grown, quickly zipped it back to Brownsville.
Really? What prompted your move right back to Brownsville?
Well, it was really in my soul. I mean, I remember as a kid with my daddy walking. We didn't have a car. You know, it was like 1952, 53, 54. And we didn't have a car, so we walked the neighborhood, and I remember walking the neighborhood. And one of my favorite memories is going out on Halloween and with Daddy, and we would go to the stores on 47th Street, and they didn't give you candy, they gave you pennies. So you might have an apple and a whole bag of pennies. And I just remember that. So it just stuck with me. My father's family lived in Brownsville. They owned homes in Brownsville in the 50s. So it's just something that's hard to explain, but it's in my soul. I really believe in diverse community. So my mantra has been, I've always lived in diverse communities. I look at Hyde Park, having spent, you know, 20 years in Hyde Park, as sort of a model of how communities can work and how residents can own their community, control what goes on in their community. So I think that's something that we really want to be able to do. I want us to keep our African American heritage as we are diverse. So once again, my mantra has been, I want to have a diverse community. I just don't want to be the minority this time. Change the culture and the individuality as an African American community. And to do all of that, you got to have economic development. I mean, you got to have jobs. You got to have. I mean, I am a founder of the Brownsville Retail Initiative. And our goal is to create walkable retail corridors in Brownsville. I mean, your whole sense of community happens up and down those streets, 7th Street, you know, in the past, 43rd Street in the past, and to try to figure out what the new commercial strip looks like. Commercial strips define communities. I mean, you can, if you think about driving through communities, you drive down commercial strips. Now, you can have great housing, great residential, but if you don't, the only thing that gets you out of the car unless you're going to a destination is somebody's house, it's the commercial strip. And so you sort of look at the commercial strip and see what, so you see what Andersonville is. You know, how many people are driving down the side streets, everybody's on Clark Street or whatever it's like. Ah, this is a great place to be. So that's very important to the economic development of the community. Part of my concern is that we maintain the flavor of the community. I think it's a challenge because the price points are a lot higher, but people's salaries haven't zipped up with the price points. So if we could have a diverse, thriving community with a African-American historical base, cultural historical base, with good schools, lots of arts and culture, good economic development, it can be like your Hyde Park, but it would demonstrate that it doesn't have to be University of Chicago based. It doesn't have to be white-based. It can be minority-based. And African-American in particular, because we have particular perception issues, So if that could happen, just imagine if that could happen. That's why I talk about the promise of Brownsville. The promise of Brownsville is bigger than what it is to be here. It also projects what could be. I mean, I know how the cycles work, and how the gentrification works, but it doesn't have to be that. So, if people, if we could be a model for what a diversified African-American cultural-based community can be, and that would be great for the city. Okay?
Thank you so much.
A big part of the work while I was at the Arts Alliance is to get artists and creatives to lean in and to get more actively involved in public life and to really flex their activism muscles and to give voice to public policies that support the arts in people's lives, schools, and communities. I am a big believer that there's a strong connection between artistry and citizenry, that creating and sharing art is one of the most powerful ways to strengthen our democracy and promote vibrant communities. And the work that I'm in now is really around political reform and public policy, and how we can change the rules that govern political participation to make them more fair and functional and inclusive. Also, a big part of the work that I'm involved in now is getting more people, average people, to tune in and get actively involved in civic life, to climb the ladder of civic engagement. I am a proud Chicagoan and resident of Bronzeville. I've been in the neighborhood since the early 2000s. What attracted me to the neighborhood is the rich history that exists in Bronzeville. It's a mecca for Black creativity and entrepreneurship and ingenuity. You know, we have these stately boulevards. We have just the architectural artistry of the homes, these handsome, muscular, beautiful gray stones and brown stones. And then the people, you know, the artists and intellectuals and businessmen and women that call Bronzeville home is stunning. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find any other neighborhood in the world that has as rich a history and legacy as Bronzeville does. I live in a home that was owned by a legendary jazz man named Sonny Stitt. I live right next door to the home of Dr. Daniel Hale Williams, who performed the world's first successful open heart surgery. I live around the corner from the home of Louis Armstrong. Bronzeville has such a textured history of creativity, and that's one of the many reasons why I'm proud to call Bronzeville home. I think there's a really powerful connection between the arts and creative expression and the Bronzeville community. I think one of the things that I really appreciate about the neighborhood is the public art. 2017 is the year of public art for Chicago. Bronzeville is home to some of the world's most famous public art installations. And I think about the Wall of Respect and the impact that that had here in Chicago and around the world. I think there's a really strong connection between the arts and community building. When you think about how you build and foster a sense of community and connection, you do that by getting people up off of their couches, away from their TV screens and their iPads and their iPhones. You bring them together for shared experience. You create opportunities for people to look each other in the eye. You create openings where people can interact, and that's something that the arts, it provides that platform. And
now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare Black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if Black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically Black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for Black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. They're going to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show me your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
Sitting here right now with the author of Teens, yes, Brother Nathan Thompson, a Chicago legend. What made you write this book? Why is it important that these stories be told?
This started many years ago. The cats that I grew up with, you know, we were real into these gangster movies. We went into them so much, it occurred to me one time that I knew more about the history of the Italians than I did about black people. So, you know, I wanted to know, what were the brothers doing back in the Al Capone days? So that's really how it got started. Me, a conversation with a buddy of mine, a 40-ounce in a joint. That's really how it got started. That's a true story. So not long after that, I walked into Woodson Library, and I didn't leave for 14 years. And during that time is when I looked up the history of black Chicago and learned all about the numbers and policy and our role in it, what all that was doing for us as a people. So we moved from there to... I actually wanted to do a screenplay first, but then it just kind of occurred to me that I would come off a lot better if I actually did a book on this. And at that time, I had never written a book in my life, but I was so moved by the story, I figured it out, and I made the book happen. And the motivating factor for me, staying involved with it and doing it, I got to a place where I really wanted black men to see another side of themselves other than the side that has been presented by Hollywood my whole life. That was the driving factor. Brothers need to see other things we were doing as opposed to the things that other people created for us to do.
Even the, what are some things that you were shocked to find out?
One of the things that shocked me the most was just how much money certain black people had back during the time that history defines as the Great Depression. You're talking about some brothers in Chicago that were millionaires and hundred-thousandaires during the Depression. And that led to the discovery that we were just about the only guys in town making any real money during those years. And that's one of the things that made it so lucrative for white gangsters to come after. During its heyday, I think the guys were just too busy hustling to really... They probably didn't figure it out themselves that, you know, hey, man, this is big what we're doing. I don't know if they ever concluded that themselves because they were in the moment and they were doing what they needed to do. But when you look back at it as you know, a brief in the timeline of our history, it is a phenomenon. When you look at where black people came up from, see, history in this country is defined in terms of very specific eras. We tend to talk a lot about the so-called civil rights era, Martin Luther King and all this business. There was a lot more civil rights going on among black people in the days prior to the so-called civil rights era. When you go back to the 1920s and 30s and 40s, as a people, we had far more unity than we do today. We're grasping for unity today. We're scraping the jar today for unity. For one thing, when you're talking about the 1920s and the 1930s, you're in a time period that is a lot closer to the days of emancipation and reconstruction as compared to now. We're decades and generations away from that. As a people, we don't feel about that how we felt about it in the 1920s and 30s. Okay, we were closer to it. Our parents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents were literally 1 foot out of that life. A couple of people that are mentioned in my book as it relates to the opening of the Jones Brothers store on 47th Street. This was the biggest thing that happened to the black community in those days, 1937. There's an elderly couple that's there in the crowd, this grand opening. This elderly couple had both been born in slavery. They come out of slavery, and now all of these great things are happening with black people in Chicago. They saved their pennies for years, or for months in this case, so they could come to this opening and buy some things to send to their grandchildren still in the South. I mean, that is a really, really big deal. This couple, I think, was like in their 80s or something like that. Robert Abbott wrote about them in an editorial on the day of, about the event, about the opening. And he dedicated an editorial to this couple, and it just blew me away. It just really blew me away. So when I talk about being closer to the feeling of all of that, this is an elderly couple in 1937 who was born in slavery. They have a lot more feeling and a lot more depth to their feeling about what all of this store opening means. So you fast forward into modern day, these are things that we take for granted. So for us to find the unity that we're looking for today, we have to first find some understanding and come to terms with the understanding of yesterday. We have to reorient our minds in that direction, because the first black whatever is not as important today as it was 50 years ago or 75 years ago. And it's a tragedy that we have lost that as a people. That's one of the things that kept us grounded and moving forward in a progressive way.
Can you talk a little bit about the politics when you talk about the mayor of Bronzeville and how important that was in terms of the politics that we had and how that then reflected, you know, too, with the policy?
Well, the mayor of Bronzeville piece, that begins with Jimmy Gentry. He's the man that is credited with coining the name Bronzeville. He was a entertainment promoter, among other things. He worked at first the Chicago Beat newspaper and then later the Chicago Defender newspaper. So it's James Gentry who once upon a time used to run these promotions for the Miss Bronze beauty pageants. So this is where the whole Bronzeville piece gets born out of, and it leads to the mayor of Bronzeville piece. So Gentry first tried this with the B newspaper. For whatever reason, it didn't work there. So by 1933-34, he had moved over to the Chicago Defender and brought the plan there with them, and it was able to be successful there. And it was successful there because of a couple of things. Number one, Robert Abbott, the founder and publisher of the Chicago Defender newspaper, was a race man. And in those days, you know, that label, race man, that means you're a man about the business of the race, promoting the race, progress for black people.
Okay.
He was a race man. He was the one that put the call out for black people to come up from the South and come on up north. What we know today as the Great Black Migration. Robert Abbott himself calls it the Great Northern Drive. And it was about getting up out of the oppressive South, coming up north for jobs. And steel mill was part of that. This was done in waves. He puts out the call, we come up. There's a lot of progress going on. The mayor of Bronzeville piece worked at this time because it became part of that because of Robert Abbott and because of the Policy King's work that was going on with the Chicago Defender newspaper in the neighborhood. Here is Robert Abbott, who owns the premier black newspaper in the country, who's joined at the hip with Ed Jones, the biggest Policy King in the country, who controls an army of 4,000-6,000 men and women. That's what made it work. Now, you can fast forward from that thought process to the time of Harold Washington's first election. A lot of things got Harold Washington elected. One of the things that that got Harold Washington elected that doesn't get discussed a lot is the street piece. Drug dealers gave their customers discounts when they came to cop if they showed the stub that they had been to vote.
Mm.
This was done on layers. You know that phrase, all hands on deck?
Mm-hmm.
We were all in the mix. Wasn't no Negro sitting off in the corner not giving a fuck about nothing. No, everybody was in this. The unity of black people at that time in Chicago is what made Harold Washington happen as mayor. So again, going back to the days of policy, going back to the days of the mayor of Bronzeville, that was a big deal for us. Some people believe that he was murdered. Some people believe that his health issues led to his heart attack. And there is reasonable argument on both sides of the equation. But August 4th, 1952, that was the day they murdered Ted Roth. People say Bronzeville died that night too. Yeah. The thing that you take away from that, mm-hmm. when you walk through the entire story timeline, you look at the pivotal moments in politics and who was in control of them. When you look at the gang warfares that were going on, you look at how we survived that. So when you talk about what do we take from all of that, mm-hmm. that we can move forward with. Standing on your square and what you believe in is certainly one of the things that you take away from that.
Absolutely.
When you look at the history of numbers and policy in the country as a whole, you find markets like Pittsburgh and other cities that folded, they gave in to mob pressure. Very early on, Brothers in Chicago stayed the course for more than 30 years. So the thing is, the unity that we have, that we had in those days, was a galvanizing unity. This is why it's important to understand that when you are in the 1920s and you're in the 1930s, you are closer in time to the time of emancipation and Reconstruction. Reconstruction, or should I say the architects of the Reconstruction era, gave up on us and threw in the towel. In that moment, we were left to fend for ourselves. In that moment, we realized this nation, or the people that run it, are not going to do anything for us. So we figured out something to do, and it worked for us. So as I always say, we're not trying to reinvent the wheel. When we talk about trying to create black unity today, that is not a new phenomenon. We need to learn from our past, not just close the door on our past and keep moving. There are great things that we did that we need to learn from and reevaluate why we left the Republican Party and joined the Democratic Party. Do we need to stay in the Democratic Party, flip back to the Republican Party, or create our own political entity? That is something that we did not do. We did not stop to reevaluate. We became complacent and kept, or at least we thought we kept moving forward. Funny thing is, every step we took, we were still getting killed, shot, bombed, and marginalized. So what's really happening? So it's important for us to learn from our history so that our futures are controlled by us, our present and our future. And we can only do that. You can only convince someone that they are capable of doing something if you show them and prove to them you've actually already done this before. Mm-hmm. You just stopped believing in yourself. That's your problem. Start to believe in yourself again. Then you will find your capability. Then you will find your action. Look at how the politics operated then compared to now. What steps we took then as opposed to now that caused us to control our politics. When we were in control of our politics, we were in control of our neighborhood, we were in control of our present and our future. Driven by our elders who had been where we had been. We were respectful enough to listen to our elders and learn from our elders. We lost all of that some time ago, and now we're just all over the map.
And many of this can be found in the books King,
absolutely,
correct?
Absolutely. I give you a timeline. History runs from 1885 into present day, and it walks you through all of the political changeovers, all of the racketeer changeovers, what happened when policy was taken over, who took it over, what they did with it, how they lost it, and how the state ultimately took it and created the state lottery. Because that wasn't just Illinois, that's going on all over this country. The success of state lotteries across this country are built on and patterned after the success of the black policy and numbers operators. That's a fact. And it's still our money that's being spent on the lottery predominantly. So we need to figure out what we need to be doing with our money.
Ooh, it's a whole lot to unpack with Tim Norman, child. This Tim Norman situation, I don't even know what to say. If y'all have been under a rock, news broke yesterday that Tim Norman, the son of Miss Robbie over at Sweetie Pies, had been arrested on federal charges stemming from the 2016 murder of his nephew, 18-year-old Andre Montgomery. Whew, a lot of this played out on the show, Sweetie Pies. Tim Norman and his mom had actually went to the location where the nephew had been shot, you know, on the show. People are now on that clip on online. Like, let me go look and see what they saying on this clip. Hold on. Online on this clip, they was like dragging him on the Sweetie Pies clip. Sweetie Pies, hold on. Here it is right here. And they want y'all to know, honey, that they see Tim. They knew something was up with Tim. They're saying all kinds of things. We're going to talk about the story in a second, but I just wanted to be nosy real quick. The people in the comment section saying that dude is what a definition of a snake, a devil, and then go back to the scene with his mom. They said sometimes it'd be your own family, and to think Tim is the reason why Andre is dead. Wow. So everybody over there looking at the clip, because this clip came out in 2016 and they were actually at the site, the location where he was shot in St. Louis. And it's just interesting. So the story goes, let me put his picture back up, that, and that's his mugshot. He's smiling in his mugshot. He's been investigated ever since it happened. There's a stripper involved. A stripper arrived in, let me just read it, child, because I can't go by memory. It is too much going on in this damn news. James Timothy Norman's reality TV show storyline often featured his search for redemption from a violent past. So Tuesday's news of his alleged murder-for-hire plot shook viewers who watched him mourn the death he is now accused of facilitating. Norman, 41, was a star on Welcome to Sweetie Pies, a reality show that ran for 5 seasons on OWN and highlighted Sweetie Pies, a new St. Louis area soul food business owned by Norman's mother, Robbie Montgomery. Norman was arrested Tuesday and accused in federal court of orchestrating the shooting death of his 21-year-old nephew, Andre Montgomery Jr. The nephew, who also appeared on the show, was Robbie Montgomery's grandson. Federal authorities say Norman hired Terica Ellis, a former St. Louis County resident who was working in Memphis, Tennessee, as an exotic dancer to help in the March 2016 killing near Fairground Park. Prosecutors say Norman then attempted to collect on the life insurance benefits of his nephew's death. On Wednesday, past TV clips of Norman's reaction to his nephew's death circulated online. Norman had visited the scene, which we just watched, of the killing with his mother, along with TV cameras for a 2016 episode. During that episode, he said, since Andre's passing, I haven't gone through that part of the city. Really, I've been avoiding it. The 21-year-old was killed the 3900 block of Natural Bridge Avenue, not far from where his father was killed shortly before Norman's birth. Wow. Robbie Montgomery's nephew was also shot and killed nearby. Norman, in a later episode, sat a few seats from his mother as she was interviewed about her grandson's killer. So the timeline of events is as follows. Prosecutors say that Tim Norman, took out a $450,000 life insurance policy on his nephew, Andre Montgomery Jr. in 2014, making himself the sole beneficiary of said policy. Whew, it's always money, huh? It's always about the money. Hold on, let me go back. He also made false statements about his nephew's income and family history in the policy documents. Montgomery was 18 when Norman took out the policy, but he said he had a family and he was married. Montgomery had been featured on the show 1 year earlier, graduating from McClure North High School. The show documented the teen's transition, moving from Texas to live with his grandmother near St. Louis so she could help him get through school. In March 2016, Norman had moved to Los Angeles near a new restaurant he owned in Inglewood. Early in the morning, the day his nephew was killed, Norman arrived in St. Louis by plane and booked a room at the Chase Park Hotel, according to court documents. By 1 p.m. that day, two burner phones, prosecutors say were used by Ellis and Norman, were activated in St. Louis. Court documents claim that at 7 p.m. that night, Montgomery texted Ellis the address of the recording studio where Montgomery, an aspiring rapper, was working. At about an hour later, he was shot at the same location. After receiving Montgomery's text, prosecutors say Ellis immediately called Norman. Witnesses told police that Montgomery took a call just before 8 p.m. that night and went outside to meet someone. Honey, they've been watching them a long time. A review of his phone records showed police that Montgomery spoke to two people in the 10 minutes before he was shot. Ellis and one other friend. So he had talked to the stripper girl and one other friend. Prosecutors say Ellis was saved in Montgomery's phone under her stage name and Instagram handle, Alexis the Great. Ellis's phone data also put her at the scene of the crime, according to the documents. And despite being at the scene of Montgomery's murder at 8:02 p.m., the documents state that Ellis' call was not to police, but she called Tim Norman at 8:03 p.m. Prosecutors say location data show Ellis then drove away from the scene and headed back to Memphis, Tennessee. The burner phones were turned off the next day and never used again. Over the next few days, Ellis deposited more than $9,000 in cash into several bank accounts. A week after the death, Norman contacted a life insurance company and attempted to collect on his nephew's policy, but he never received the money because of lack of documentation. Oh, wow, it's a whole lot. Norman was upfront about his criminal past, blah, 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 after describing the difficulty in rebuilding a life after spending 10 years in prison as a teen. Norman was 17 and a senior at Hazelwood Central High School in 1997 when he and another teen were charged with a series of felonies. So Norman, you know, he has his own struggles. A lot of people have been hitting me up in my DM, said that, you know, it's rumor around St. Louis that, you know, he had allegedly, you know, molested the nephew when he was young and the nephew was going to tell, and it was all kind of stuff that's going on. So we'll never know what the complete story is, and I'm sure there will be more details. Oh, it's a lot. It's a whole lot. You said for the love of money, prepaid. Child, y'all talk about Tim and them hips. Like, we always knew something was wrong. We always knew something was wrong. Let me finish looking at this article, seeing what else they got in here. It's a whole lot in this article. Tim's mother sued him back in June 2016, claiming his operation of Three Sweetie Pies restaurants was a copyright infringement. So Norman wanted to expand the business into a national chain, but he eventually had to close several locations. Now, that's interesting because in this, you know, in my DM, they were saying that they feel like the mom was part of the investigation because apparently the nephew had confided in the mom. And this is just word on the street, so I don't know. I don't know. In April 2017, Norman was charged with misdemeanor assault at a Houston's restaurant located location that has since closed. A former chef at the restaurant accused Norman of punching him in the face when the chef asked him about paychecks for other employees. That case is ongoing. Norman was living in Jackson, Mississippi, where he co-owns another Sweetie Pies location at the time of his arrest. He faces a charge of conspiracy to use interstate commerce facilities in commission of a murder for hire. Now, let's talk about Terica for a minute. Here's her mugshot because she got arrested also. Terica is the exotic dancer that, you know, was in the phone, and they traced her phone to the location. So prosecutors will not say how Ellis and Norman met, how Terica met the nephew, but court records show that Ellis lived for a time in St. Louis. Ellis was living in Floriston in 2010, according to court documents tied to a landlord dispute. Court documents say she later moved to Memphis, but would occasionally return to visit the St. Louis area. Court documents also show Ellis has two misdemeanor convictions from 2006 to 2007. One is an indecent exposure charge connected to her employment at the time at the Pure Passion Strip Club in Memphis. The other is a drug possession offense. Ellis was arrested in July and faces the same conspiracy to murder for hire charge as Norman. So she's been locked up a little longer than he has. So I guess, you know, she provided more details to the case. Oh, I didn't even put the picture in there. Miss Robbie was teaching Andre the business. He said Pure Passion. You was at, you know what Pure Passion is, John John? You been there? You been in that strip club? Never trust a man with childbearing. She only got $9,000 to ruin her life, child. It sounds like something that'll be on one of those on TV shows, the ID Network, late at night. I don't know what's going on. It's just unfortunate that, like, he would do that to his own family member. That means you don't give a damn about nobody. If he'll do that to his nephew, he'll do that to his mom. How many other people he got insurance policies on that he might be looking to cash in on? How many others?
Welcome to my very first video called Pandemics and Money. This is hopefully going to be the first video in a series about gift economy and money and how they relate, how pandemics are actually an outgrowth of money itself. And I'll explain how and why. First of all, we see that pandemics have been a given fact of civilization since it began thousands of years ago. And what is civilization but the domestication of other species? This is the very foundation of civilization. It's the decision to domesticate both plants and animals and to live in close proximity with domestic animals. And we know that the life cycles of organisms such as viruses and bacteria and parasites is often dependent upon two or more species together, because life cycles complete themselves through jumping from one species to another. Or, as in the case of a virus, it often begins in one species and jumps into another species, which has no immunity against the virus, so it grows exponentially. Now, viruses and bacteria and parasites naturally occur in wild nature, but they're kept in check because animals don't live naturally in such close proximity in massive populations with other species. This is a result of civilization as we know it. Civilization is quite new in the evolutionary scene. As far as I know, we're the only species that owns other species, owns and domesticates. I'm going to cut the euphemisms and call domestication for what it is. It's slavery. It's control of another species. It's denying the autonomy of another species. That's all it is. When you domesticate another species, you breed it to be perpetually immature. You control its sexual life so that it's not free to sexually reproduce and explore without your control. And often it's bred to not even reproduce sexually at all. We mow grass before it goes to seed. We can't allow it to reproduce freely. We have to control it. And we own another species because we want to control and reproduce it for food, either food or other utilitarian uses, such as riding horses or yokes of oxen pulling plows, or dogs providing services. Or the purpose might just be we want a perpetual baby to take care of that we think is cute. And this is what domestication does. It creates a state of perpetual immaturity in animals because immature animals are easier to control and they're non-aggressive. Especially now we have an inordinate amount of domestic animals and humans as opposed to wild animals. Right now in human history, 96% of biomass of mammals on Earth is domestic animals, and only 4.2% of the biomass of mammals. This is a flip from the way it was only like 1,000 years ago. So my theory has been that animal domestication and plant domestication and money, trade, credit and debt thinking all came in one package because they're based on the same principle. And I believe many of our mythologies will happening. For example, our own in Western tradition, Garden of Eden story, it talks about the fall from grace, which I have interpreted to mean the fall from grace, from gratis, from gift economy. And with this fall came the ideas of credit and debt. And with it came agriculture, tilling the ground by the sweat of our brows, separation of male and female, domination of male over female. This is part of the Eden story, and clothes. And in other myths, it's the concept of stealing fire from heaven, which I'm not going to go into that right here, but it's the same idea. It's what separates us from wild nature. So the way agriculture works is you plant a seed, you invest the seed, and you wait for the produce. You wait for the reward. This is the same concept as money. We even call it a seed investment. An investment, and you wait for the returns. It's the principle of money. And this is opposed to the principle of, we could call it pay it forward in nature. For example, a bird eats a seed from a tree, eats fruit, swallows the seed, and poops it out somewhere else. And the bird doesn't sit there and cultivate the seed and wait for the produce. It pays it forward. Something else will reap the fruits of the labor of the bird, so-called labor. Bird is doing his thing. Same with the bear eating raspberries. There's no conception of, I have to pay this raspberry bush back. The bear eats the raspberry and moves on. And the raspberry bush, as far as it's concerned, it's receiving a service by the bear eating its berries. There's no idea of receiving and giving a service. It's all one thing. Is a bear giving a service or receiving a service when it poops in the ground? And are the organisms in the ground receiving a service or giving a service when they eat that poop? Or when a seed sprouts from the poop? The cycles continue, a perfect balance in the natural order. And I say that this is precisely because there's no consciousness of credit and debt as there is in human civilization. Credit and debt thinking comes planting and reaping the rewards of what we plant. And even our religious traditions recommend against this. If you want to follow the spiritual path, you give expecting nothing in return. You pay it forward. This is a concept in the Bible. It's a concept in the Quran. It's a concept in the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita is very clear on this. It even calls it relinquishing the rewards or the fruits of your own actions. It actually uses the word fruit as if you're planting a seed. And the whole concept of money is planting a seed and waiting for rewards from that. It's taking rewards for your own actions. Working for money puts us into a state of delusion. Money represents self-credit, right? I work for a reward. I deserve it. Money represents working for my own reward. And what is reward but praise? And praise and price come from the same root. I work for my own praise. I work for my own price. Whereas in the world of reality, nothing comes from us individually. Everything comes from the whole. We are a product of the whole. We're a product of our culture. We're a product of our biology. We're a product of the whole universe. In fact, all of the energy that is running my body right now comes from the sun. It does not come from me. So I can't take credit for that. So basically, not working for money is acknowledging all credit to the whole, all credit to the all praise to the all. Hallelujah. And Jesus himself even said, I can do nothing of myself. This is the very principle of not working for money. Also, what comes with this thinking is ownership. That's what domestication is. It's ownership of animals and plants and the processes of nature. It's control over the processes of nature that already instinctively, naturally happen. For example, in our civilization, we have an aversion to anything that's wild. We keep wild separate from us. And we don't allow it within the walls of our civilization. Walk around any suburban neighborhood and see how many people obsessively get rid of weeds, because weeds are wild or feral. They have their own authority. Civilization, domestication cannot stand us having our own authority. We have to go to somebody else for authority. We can't allow any other species to have its own authority within the walls of civilization. What we don't understand is we are as domesticated as the creatures we domesticate. In fact, there's no reason any creature would want to domesticate another creature unless it is immature. It is immaturity that causes us to own another creature, whether it's slavery of humans or slavery of animals. And we become what we control. So the authorities that we put ourselves in submission under also are domesticated and immature. Because what mature person would want to control another? What mature person would want to deny another autonomy, self-authority? Now our agriculture has evolved into factory farming, massive amounts of animals in inhumane conditions living together and in close proximity with us. Education is overpopulation. We overpopulate the domestic animals that we raise. We overpopulate ourselves. And also, what I believe comes in the same package as money and agriculture, domestication, is cancer. Cancer has been shown to exist in prehistory from fossil findings, but it looks relatively rare until civilization comes along, and then all of a sudden cancer is found all over in the civilized world. This is just a hunch, this is intuition, but I feel like cancer, civilization also come in together, that cancer is a manifestation of money thinking. The only two things that I can think of that think that unlimited growth is a virtue are cancer and monetary economy. Go to any city or county council meeting and what's the one thing that no one will dare question in its unlimited growth? If your economy is not growing perpetually, then we think there's something wrong. And the only other organism that I can think of that thinks this way is cancer, if you can call it thinking. It runs on the principle of cancer, economy, human population, and even CO2 levels in the climate. They all grow exponentially and they coincide together. There is a correlation, and with overpopulation of both humans and animals comes pandemics also. Big populations of animals and humans living together breeds pandemics. In addition to this overpopulation of animals in factory farms is the excessive use, and the same thing happens in our hospitals. These extremely sterile environments, of course, weed out the weaker microbes, and the strongest survive by the laws of natural selection. We're creating super germs. We already see this happening in hospitals. We are creating not only pandemics, but super germ pandemics. It's inevitable that we will see more pandemics as time goes, because we are the petri dish of pandemics.
Okay. Let me get organized here. I'm on more than one electronic device at a time. All right, let me cut that one. I'll cut this one. Oh, man. Let's see. Okay, let me cut this one off. All right, let me get this laptop over here. Okay. Today's podcast is titled It's My House, Bronzeville. Last night, we held our first official Zoom conference call for the geographical area of Chicago. I would say the Chicagoland area, which it's the way we look at it is pretty broad. And Bronzeville is a district or area within Chicago that's got a lot of historic stuff to it. Anyway, but went well. We didn't plan on going an hour, but it some kind of way ended up an hour. So that program is co-hosted. We have a co-host that one, female host, Reba LaMaestra, and that. Now we did it last night. Our times will be it's on three times a week. Last night was the first one. So the days are Sunday, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. Sundays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. All at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, or if you're in the Midwest, Central Time Zone, 6 p.m., just for your local time zone wherever you're on the planet. So that's easy. It's My House, Bronzeville. And where's Bronzeville? It's in Chicago. Because we want to concentrate on the ground social building events. Now, what I mean by that is this. We're actually going to offer workshops and retreats where people can, you don't have to know anything about carpentry or whatever, that we'll be offering classes and workshops and retreats on this on the ground for people that live up in that neck of the woods. All right, we got some other locations, which we'll be announcing those as the, I guess, days or weeks pass by. But, more like days instead of weeks. But so It's My House, Bronzeville, for the Zoom meeting. And you don't have to live in the Chicago area. You just might want to be interested, because you might be interested in us doing it in your neck of the woods. The thing with these Zoom meetings, we've got an on-the-ground partner that actually lives in that area. So Reba LaMaestra actually lives in Chicago. So we'll be doing things in Bronzeville, as well as Pembroke. That's an hour away, 45 minutes an hour away. Pembroke, Illinois, Hopkins Park, Illinois, and points in between. All right. So that's Sunday night. The conference call for that is Sunday night, Tuesday night, or even it's more like evening. Sunday evening, Tuesday evening, Thursday evenings, starting at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, or 1 hour behind, which is 6 p.m. Central Standard Time. And those, let's say, run from 30 minutes to no more than 1 hour. Okay. And we just did a conference call last night, but then a lot of those conference calls, as we move on week by week, will have an activity, a building activity, so you can actually see us working on actual projects, building projects, in any event. So, all right, well, that's it. And then we'll announce. So that's 12 times a month that Reba will be on with that. 12 times a month, 3 times a week. And then we got other. And what's interesting, because it's my house, we're on 20 times a month. Actually, we were traditionally on 20 times a month. Then we added on 2 more shows over the weekend. So we went from 20 times a month to 28 times a month, because we got a sewing show on Sunday and then a compound show, how to put together your own private compound for a living. So that's 20, 28, and then we just added on with the It's My House Bronzeville, 12 more. So we got more coming. Okay. So people, you know, just take your pick of what you want. But the key is now is basically, okay, we have an offline partner that lives in a geographical location. So if you're in that neck of the woods or want to visit that neck of the woods or near that neck of the woods, you can go on and we can meet and mingle and build something together in a social setting. So anyway, that's the latest update on that. Now, I wasn't expecting to play one of the audios I played this morning on, what's this guy's name? Tim Norman. Because he has been convicted by social media and without his day in court. He was Tim Norman, who, if you watch the TV show on the OWN Network, Sweetie Pies, he was on there as a main cast member every week. He's the son of the proprietor, I just call her Sweetie Pie. I forgot her real name. She used to be one of the iCats. But in any event, they got a pretty successful family business going. And I haven't watched the show in probably about a good 3 years. Yeah, I haven't watched the show in about a good 3 years. But anyway, apparently he was arrested for, conspiracy to commit murder. He had a nephew, I guess it's a nephew, or a cousin, probably a cousin, I don't know. But who was killed, I guess 4 years ago, something like that, 4 years ago. And He's been federally charged. There might be some more charges coming because it looks like it could be a possible insurance fraud case as well. But like I said, I just went on and bit because this. So I just read the comments and just man, what's the guilty? No, innocent until proven guilty. But if you look at social media, channel by channel, you read the comments, it's more like guilty until proven innocent. But the optics do look bad. And here's why the optics really look bad, is he took out an insurance policy on his, I guess it's his cousin. Before I go to the phone, wait a minute, let me just feel a little bit, to see the relationship.
Ooh, it's a whole lot to unpack with Tim Norman, child. This Tim Norman situation, I don't even know what to say. If y'all have been under a rock, news broke yesterday that Tim Norman, the son of Miss Robbie over at Sweetie Pies, had been arrested on federal charges stemming from the 2016 murder of his nephew, 18-year-old Andre Montgomery.
Okay, so apparently he had taken out an insurance policy on his nephew, who was 18, and I think it was like $450,000. Now, optically, that looks really bad. The dude was only 18 years old, but from part of the backstory I've heard, online, whatever that means, that his nephew did have a family. So, you know, there's a lot of backstory we don't know about. However, like I said, social media to a very high degree has guilty until proven innocent. That's bad, but you know, like I say, the optics look bad, and then to make matters worse, he's been federally charged, and the feds have a very high conviction rate. So, but I think, like I said, I think he's been charged. It's conspiracy with murder, and conspiracy says you didn't do it. You didn't do the deed. But you and at least one other person planned on doing the deed or arranged for the deed to be done. So anyway, early in the game for that. But yeah, it's story. I mean, anyway. And I would say on a high-profile level, that family was setting a pretty good example for black entrepreneurship. I know one episode that I saw him on, some kind of soundbite. He wanted Sweetie Pies to be the first black-owned soul food franchise business in the country. Or let's say, yeah, nationwide, because you do have, in the past, you do have, matter of fact, there was a guy, I forgot the dude's name, Ted Holmes, I think, out of Baltimore. I don't know what happened to him. He had a franchise in the D.C., Baltimore area several years ago. Called Chicken George. The lines were out the door. Sold a good product at a good price, but for some reason they went out of business. I mean, the lines were out of the door. one of his innovations was, you know, because some a lot of people like greens, cooked greens. I guess it was collard greens, but he, but the biscuits were good. The product was good. That's good. Good. I'm a kale person, spinach person myself. He didn't sell that, but I really don't care for collard greens. But the product, I mean, the biscuits, the chicken, all that, it was good. It, you know, lines out the door. But for some reason, he went out of business. So, and that was a regional thing. With Sweetie Pies, thanks to the internet and cable television, you know, was a lot more known. And just on the strength of that cable TV show, I'm sure they got inquiries from people all across the country that would have liked to partner up with them or buy a franchise if they had ever organized that. So, in any event, Tim Norman, there's a bunch of news about this current his debacle in his life, and then some better times as well. We'll follow up on that. But in any event, tune in Sunday, and then you can go to It's My House News on Facebook, and then you'll get the latest updates on whatever we're doing. All right, so. Okay, let's take a call. 314, your mic is open.
Yeah, all that stuff is true. I know this person. Ate in a restaurant. But
you
I don't
talking
eat
about
soul
Tim Norman?
Food. I know Robbie.
Oh, Robbie. The mother, the owner. Mm-hmm.
She bought a building in University City.
Mm-hmm.
And turned around next week and sold it like three times more than she paid for it, like maybe $4.5 million, something like that.
Well, she's got her name behind her now, so.
Yeah,
that
well, see, that's
TV
what I say, man.
Hurt.
There's two things here, at least, maybe more. One, this is what human beings do.
Mm-hmm.
And two, some people just ain't don't appreciate. And these are, let's say, these. And I'm going to do like social media does Donald Trump. This is Democratic supporters. That's exactly
mm-hmm.
what they do. Out there with in U City, in Maria Chappelle Nadell's area, the lady that said, I hope that Donald Trump is assassinated on her Twitter. And they turn around, vote her right back in. That goes to show you them double standards. People get pissed off at me because I don't live through all these individuals, know them very closely.
Uh-huh.
I've been around them closely and can make these comments.
Yeah, it's social
you know,
media. It because I look through a bunch of social media, just the comments. You know, why they even playing the video sometimes first? And I didn't see, man, they didn't cut. He's been roasted all the way. I said, well, so much for innocent until proven guilty.
Well, no,
but
they do Donald Trump
bad.
Like that.
They
do Donald.
True.
I got a guy in Atlanta
that's
called
true.
Me up and said, yeah.
They do roast Trump. They roast him.
Yeah. Yeah, to talk about, well, they don't lock. Why Donald Trump have all these criminals around him, Bannon? I said, well, the man is charged. He ain't been convicted.
Right.
That's him.
Mm-hmm.
And then they skip over. They skip over the one. They skip over when somebody black does something. I happened to come across some data and with pictures of all these black female police officers that's being killed by black males. Have you seen that?
No.
Even as recently, I had found at least, well, females, at least four. Then you got males, about another four or five. Nothing is being said. No Black Lives Matter, no marching, none of that stuff. No protesting. But let a white cop shoot a black person. You see what I'm talking about, L.A.?
Right, yeah. All hell breaks loose when that happens.
Now, something must be wrong in the mentality of an individual that does that, you know, try to take up for it or put it under the rug.
Yeah.
Just like these shootings in Chicago, 1,200 and 64. No, 1,358 through this past Tuesday. And no white cop shot nobody. No white cops. 219 killed. No white cops killed no black person. No marching,
no
protest.
We all know it's only news when it's black and white.
And it ain't about CNN and MSNBC, Atlantic don't report it. The Root doesn't report it. And they black news media. Well, anyway, getting back to the topic of your show. You should charge people for that, man. I don't know why you do this stuff for nothing.
You talking about Bronzeville?
Yeah, these classes that you're giving.
Oh,
you shouldn't do that for free.
The online stuff. I'm trying to get the word out first. The classes? No. The classes, they'll be fee for that. But I'm just talking about the online stuff. You know,
yeah, don't
the
be doing
call,
classes
that's free.
For free. Charge these people for this stuff. You know how they are.
That's true.
You know how folks are. Look at the ones that were squatting in your house. You know how they are. They turn around and try to sue you.
Yeah, you're right. I've been there before.
And maybe make sure you draw some kind of disclaimer for those who enroll, stating that you ain't promising them no success. You're not promising them no equality. You're just selling them information.
Well, that's why I like to do the hands-on. I don't like to do the book, the tape, the online course thing. I was setting up an online school, but then I got to think, you know what, there's a gazillion and one schools out here now. A lot of people offering courses, and a lot of people, just from the book and tape rah-rah days back in the 80s or 90s, a lot of people bought thousands of dollars worth of, matter of fact, Trump got sued behind some of that stuff with that Trump University. He wasn't teaching the classes. He just licensed his name. But you had a lot of people that were selling the books and tapes, and a lot of people, they buy those books and tapes, and those books and tapes hit home, and then they collect dust. And then people turn around and they want to sue you because you didn't make $1 million. Mind you, didn't do nothing to try to earn a dollar. So you're right. You're right. Need to get this disclaimer and all that.
Yeah, you got to do this. That's what you have to do. If not, these people, and plus they never will appreciate it. Many people don't appreciate a damn thing, and they'll turn around and show you that by just acting a damn fool.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm gonna tell you something else. I don't teach just anybody. I don't got away from this stuff. And you know where I'm going. I do not mess with them liberals.
Well,
especially
I can't blame you.
If they are Donald Trump haters. Go out and get Hillary to teach your ass. I ain't teaching.
She's not going to do that.
because they turn around and they work against you. I was just adding up what I made trading while you was playing that stuff this morning.
How did you do today? So far, at least.
I'll tell you here in a minute. That's too much. But anyway, so how's every? So you had you was on last night. How did it go?
That went. We didn't do no blog talk because they only allow us 2 hours a day on blog talk. So we went on Zoom, and that went well. That was ours. So and like
how many people showed up?
We had probably a total of about 7 that probably dropped in all together. What I did was I opened up on Zoom. I got a free account, but I can see I'm going to have to, and they don't charge much, bump it up to the, I think we switched over to Reba's account where we had more time. That's where we actually went to an hour. And I have another paid account, but that's not on Zoom. That's on StreamYard, and that can put us on 3 platforms. So we're. But to answer your question, we had about 7 or 8 total. I mean, they weren't all at one time. But and then we had on Periscope, I think 17. But they were just lurking, but the system registered them, and I had to go back and check the YouTube numbers. So, little bit by little bit, day by day.
Well, I hope you're successful in it.
Well, I'm a trial and error guy.
I got to go look at that small house I seen. I seen some houses someplace. 170. I made $245 since 12.
Mm-hmm.
Well, today. Now, they don't have a time on here on this one.
That's more than a day's pay for a lot of people.
Since you was on the air, because I called another friend, a guy that I instruct. And give him tips. Told him to get in on this pharmaceutical stock, the one that's doing the trials for the COVID. BioNTech, SEADR. So people say that the stock market is not doing well. They're crazy as hell. They don't know what they're talking about. I don't pay no attention to that. That's what you have to do. You got people. See, folks, and you know one thing about an individual. If they read a book or they get a little bit of information, they don't graduate and got their PhD, and they run with that information. And that information is a key that won't even go in the damn lock.
Well,
and then they
true.
Want to be
some
instructing
people
you.
Have just enough information to be dangerous.
There you go. But anyway, I appreciate what you're doing, L.A. Keep it up.
I appreciate you calling in and being supporting. And what I'm going to do is at 8 after 12, I'm going to take me a early.
Yeah, go ahead and get off. Hey, did
weekend.
You ever check that Diane Campbell? Did she ever
I
get back with you?
When you first, I did reach out to her, but I'm going to go back and reach out again. But when you told me about it, I immediately went, searched my email, found her, and then I sent her an email. So I'm going to go back because
right.
I don't check that email account every day. So,
all right, I'll
then.
Talk
we'll
to you later, buddy.
Monday.
Be careful.
Okay, bye.